And revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. We're going to go a little bit out of order on the agenda, and we have a crowded agenda. And if we don't get through these four bills this morning, we'll come back this afternoon. So I will open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 4026 on charitable activities, and start with a briefing from Chris and call up Lane Shetterly.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4026 has a simple language that would preclude the Department of Revenue from considering charitable contributions or activities when making the determination of residency for personal income tax filers. This is a common thing that the department does, and there are a host or a list of factors that can be used when either the department or the taxpayer is determining whether they are an Oregon resident or not an Oregon resident for purposes of the personal income tax. This simply puts in statute that one of those considerations may not be charitable contributions or activities.
Okay, and we have the Revenue Committee Chair Emeritus Shetterly here. Welcome, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair. Good to be with you this morning. My name is Lane Shetterly. Here this morning in my capacity as a member of the Board of Directors of Oregon Community Foundation, and I appreciate the legislature for hearing the amendment to House Bill 4026, and then you this morning hearing it as an A engrossed bill. Here's the situation that House Bill 4026A addresses. You have individuals in Oregon who spend their lives here. They grow a business. Obtain some degree of wealth, perhaps. They become supporters of their local hospital, of their local community foundation, maybe the Oregon Community Foundation. In the course of their planning with their lawyers and financial planners, they may be advised for income tax reasons or estate tax reasons or other to relocate out of state, to establish domicile in Washington or Idaho, as the case may be. And they will do that. It's unfortunate, but we know that it happens. When that happens, they are still subject to review to determine whether, even irrespective of having relocated their place of residence, their physical residence, to another state, they're still subject to review and evaluation as to whether or not they have sufficient ties to Oregon to nevertheless constitute them as sufficiently domiciled here still for the purpose of being subject to the Oregon income tax. We had a case out of the tax court last year that was very illustrative of the factors that staff mentioned that the state uses to determine whether somebody is still a domicile here of Oregon. And in that case, they looked at where they were getting medical care. They looked at where their driver's license was issued, where they were registered to vote. They looked at, among other things, where they were making their charitable giving, where their charitable activities were focused. And the fact that focus was toward Oregon counted as a tie to bring this person to a domiciliary of Oregon and being subject to income tax. Our concern about that is that we have financial advisors now and attorneys who are advising the clients when they leave the state. One of the things you need to do is stop making charitable contributions to Oregon. If you've established a charitable fund at a foundation, at the Oregon Community Foundation, stop giving to it. Stop giving to that local hospital that you had adopted while you were in Oregon, because that can be used against you. The result of that, of course, is an impact and a potentially significant impact to charitable giving in Oregon for charitable institutions and philanthropy here. And we don't want to discourage people from continuing to give here in Oregon, where they have established so many ties. But in fact, we want to encourage them to continue to give. And so this bill acknowledges that to continue to make charitable contributions to Oregon will not count as establishing domicile here, so that we are encouraging people who make these choices for other reasons to nevertheless continue to support charities and philanthropy here in Oregon. That's the gist of the bill. I thank you again for hearing it. I commend it to you and be happy to answer any questions.
Have we seen this sort of law in other states?
Frankly, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. Chris, do you know?
Yes, I believe you were talking about it the other day with DR, and at least 10 other states have adopted a similar provision.
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions?
All right. All right. Thank you very much. You bet. Good to see you.
We work second?
Yes, sir.
Nobody else signed up?
We have nobody else signed up on this bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2026A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 4026 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none. The bill will go to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Boquist will be the carrier.
Should have jumped. I'm volunteering early, so I don't know what the next one.
I'm going to close that work session and open up a work session and public hearing on House Bill 4028, dealing with a string of technical tax credits. And call up Mr. Eason to walk us through them. And there are a set of new amendments.
Actually, it's a set of four new amendments. Some of us couldn't even figure that one out.
Yes.
Okay, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yeah, House Bill 4028, there are a series of four amendments that are up there in OLIS right now. I have a document put together that actually is a table that will step through the engrossed version of the measure and then also the proposed amendments. So that's under the meeting materials of 4028. Should be the second thing down, titled Overview, House Bill 4028. Okay, so I'll start off with the changes in the engrossed version, and then I'll step through the amendments as well, which is the way the table works through. But the first change, and the changes in 4028 I should mention, are changes to a number of tax credits, and then in the amendments we have a number of changes to property tax exemptions.
Okay, where are you at? It's not the second one down. That's a Bill Cross statement. The second one's down. Meeting materials. Am I in the wrong place? Go to the committee hearing?
Yeah, I can't see. It's the second one down under the bill, so it might be further down.
I'm in. Well, there's the bill. I'm only doing this because I can't see the friggin' screen. Okay.
It's the right there that was down a little bit further on your screen.
Overview?
Yes.
All right. Please proceed now, Mr. Chair. Now I can see that.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
All right. So the first change here is related to an income tax credit available to collectors and producers of manure for biofuel. So the two changes to that tax credit, the first is a clarification of terms. It's clarifying the term bovine, which is in place there, and it now includes the term cattle, and specifies that cattle means cows, heifers, bulls, steers, or calves. So there was some concern that the correct or the intended animals weren't necessarily referenced with just the term bovine, and there was a few different definitions that were kicked around, but ultimately settled on the idea of using cattle and then specifying to make sure that we got the cows and the heifers. The second change related to the manure tax credit was comes from Department of Agriculture, who received administrative responsibilities for this tax credit. And so there's a modification relating to the $5 million annual cap on the credit. So instead of the cap will still stay at $5 million, but it's related to, rather than the credit claimed, to the certifications of the tax credit. And then it also changes the timing of it to calendar year instead of tax year. And that's to help Department of Agriculture administer the timing and the limits of the tax credit. So those are the two changes for the manure tax credit. The second one down on the table, excuse me, has to do with the Affordable Housing Lenders Credit. And there's a definitional change, and it's really aimed at allowing nonprofit corporations of a certain structure or a housing authority, if they have a controlling interest in a limited partnership, they can then qualify to be a qualified borrower for this credit. So it's a more or less a technical change here. I think we'll have some testimony on this on the need of it, but it was a tweak to the language to, it's still aimed at nonprofits, but it's just the way that they're set up. So they could be an LLC owner rather than just a straight owner of the property. So a slight tweak there. Third one down on the table, is the film and video So this is, there's no changes to the underlying tax credit. Again, this is a tax, an auctionable tax credit. But it, the change in the bill is actually aimed at the ability of the legislature to more or less fill in if the full $14 million of the credit that are to be auctioned are not auctioned. So in the recent past, the full $14 million of the credit has been auctioned. But if, for example, let's say $12 million was auctioned, the changes in the bill would allow the legislature to top up any of those unsold credits. So if $12 million were auctioned, the legislature could then appropriate $2 million to the film and video account to essentially fill in that gap in the same fiscal year. So what's in the statutory language right now would be the upcoming fiscal year. So this would change it to the legislature being able to appropriate those funds in the current fiscal year. The fourth one down is the Working Family Household and Dependent Care Credit. The engrossed version had a number of changes aimed at students with generally lower income being able to, there was imputed income and certain changes that would allow lower income students to qualify for the credit at an expanded student level. The A-17 amendment removes those changes related to the students. Again, that would, the gross version would have a revenue impact again because it's expanding a refundable tax credit. So the A-17 removes most of the language related to imputed income and students and includes some technical changes for individuals that would be able to qualify that are working out of state but are Oregon residents and do have their income taxed here in Oregon. And then there's also the measures limiting the amount of employment-related expenses to the lesser amount attributable to either spouse on a combined return plus the spouse. Some language in there, and imputed income is not there, so I'll have to change that on the table. But that's keeping in current practice with the credit up until this tax year is there's a limit on the amount of dependent care expenses that you can claim, and that one of the limits is the lesser of the spouse's income on a joint return. So if you have one spouse making $25,000, the other one's making $5,000, your limit would then be the $5,000 because it'd be the lesser of the spouse's income, lesser of the two. That's a change from the language that was actually adjusted last session that started pointing to taxpayer, which would be the sum of those two. So it's a tweak there, and that actually leads to a net positive revenue gain in the revenue impact statement. But that's staying consistent with the policy of how this credit has been administered, but that would change otherwise beginning with tax year 2018. So those are the changes related to the tax credits. And then pivoting down on the second page of the table over to the property tax exemptions, starting with the dash A-13 amendment, this would be creating a new property tax exemption, and it's related to cemetery property. Traditionally, cemetery property can qualify for a property tax exemption. However, when the property comes out of cemetery use, and in this case, it's usually going to be property that's being held or is owned by a cemetery, but it's being held for future burial plots or something to that effect. But so when that property comes out of cemetery use, there is a 10-year clawback where 10 years of back taxes must be repaid. The change in the A-13 would allow when cemetery property comes out of the property tax exempt use, if it is then transferred or sold to be used for low-income housing, and by low-income housing, it has to be, there's two property tax exemptions for low-income housing that
Eugene
could be used following the cemetery use. It would essentially wipe away the 10-year clawback of back taxes. So long as the property is used for nonprofit or is used for low-income housing for a full 10 years. So at the time the cemetery use, it was exempt from property taxes. It then is sold, but then gets used for low-income housing. There is no 10-year clawback in the back taxes for the cemeteries. There are other specifications that have to be met. And again, the use of the property, the new low-income housing use, has to qualify for a property tax exemption under, there's two statutes that are referenced there. Both of those give permissive authority to local governments to decide whether that property would qualify.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Riley.
So is there anything in those tax credits that specify how soon affordable housing has to come online, or can the property sit there as affordable housing for a while? What's the?
Yes, Senator Riley, there is language in there. I can't remember the actual time period, but There is allowance for the property to be held for future low-income housing use, but I think the language has to do with a reasonable time limit. So it's not meant to be in perpetuity, but yes, you could certainly acquire the property and then have a plan to build it out or something to that effect.
But for a reasonable time.
I believe that's the language in those statutes, yeah. Okay. And again, this is tying into existing property tax exemptions.
Understood, thank you.
Yeah.
Got a question?
Okay, so moving down one row to the -A14, new industrial property in rural areas. So this is, a change to an existing, in this case, an existing property tax exemption. There's a number of clarifications in this bill, and there's also one change that is probably considered substantive, and that's relating to the definition of what a rural area is. So this is, just as a refresher, this is a property tax exemption, is a permissive property tax exemption that allows local governments to provide a temporary property tax exemption, and there's some allowance for how the local government could specify what it would be, whether it's 100% or some fraction thereof for the amount of the exemption. For up to a number of years. And again, I believe it's limited to no more than 5 years, but the local government can specify for something less than that. The change in the bill would be the definition. This is right now in rural areas, which would be outside of a city's urban growth boundary of population greater than 40,000. The change in the A14 would allow this to include unincorporated property. So the difference there would be unincorporated property, so property that's outside of a city that may be within a UGB, would now be qualified as an area where this in property tax exemption could become available. So I'll leave the -A14 there. And then the last change is the -A16, which is related to the newly constructed low-income rental housing property tax exemption. And in this case, it's simply moving the existing law sunset date from January 1st, 2020 to July 1st, 2020. So it's just moving it 6 months to the later, and that's really aligning it up to how the assessors treat whether a property is exempt or not. And they key off of that July 1st date. So it's moving that sunset date out 6 months, but in a way really aligning it to when the assessor determines whether a property is exempt or not. So those are all the changes. We do have the paperwork. Happy to go through that this time.
Can you give us a quick thumbnail on the revenue impact of what we have in front of us?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Mr. Chair, in OLIS, you do have the revenue impact statement for the 13, 14, 16, and 17. They're all the same revenue impact statement. I just combined them all into one. So it's the same statement.
Oh, they're the same one.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I just printed 12 copies of it upstairs.
Yeah, okay.
Then figured it out.
So,
all right, that's where I was trying to add.
In an effort to reduce confusion.
The trees are coming right now, Kyle, okay? And they're all the same.
Yes.
Thank you.
We wanted to make sure we had the paperwork correct, too. I didn't want to make any mistakes there. But yes, it is the same revenue impact statement. So in terms of the changes to revenue, the Working Family Household Independent Care Tax Credit does have, again, there's a little bit of a revenue lift, and that's from changing that related to the lesser of the two spouses. Again, that's keeping with past practice, but there was a change last session that keyed off a taxpayer, so a slight definitional change. But so there's a little bit of a revenue lift there. The other remaining portions are, I haven't listed in the revenue impact, but minimal or no impact. And then for the new industrial property tax exemption and the cemetery property tax exemption, those were both given indeterminate. And that's in large part because they're dependent upon local government decision making. So these are permissive. So it's hard for us to really get a sense of or to make an accurate estimate of what the impact in revenue will be, because it depends upon what the local governments would do. We do have an example of a particular piece of cemetery property that was being discussed quite a bit on when this measure was discussed on the House side. So there's an example to give you a sense of what the impact could potentially be, but again, it'll depend upon what that land is, how many acres and that sort of thing. But just for that example, is about $230,000 was the sum total of 10 years of back taxes. But again, it'll depend upon the circumstances of any transition out of cemetery property to the low-income housing.
Okay. We have some people that will weigh in on each one of these amendments, but first we have Deanna Mack. Did you want to give us an overview from the Department of Revenue's standpoint?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and I was just here to talk about the income tax credit parts of House Bill 4028, A engrossed, and the Dash A17 amendment. During the interim, as we were trying to administer the working, in particular, the Working Family Child Independent Care Credit, or Household Independent Care Credit, we discovered some inconsistencies with federal law. And we talked with LRO about them during the interim, and that's the reason we have the bill here, is to try and fix and address some of those technical concerns. We have a duty, obviously, to share those with you as we discover them, and so that is what we did. The differences really were just between the way students were treated, as Kyle explained, and a technical correction in earned income. We wanted to make sure that taxpayers, we thought you wanted to make sure that taxpayers who actually had income that was taxable in Oregon, not just physically earned in Oregon, would also qualify. And so there's some technical corrections here. Kyle did a really good job explaining all of the concerns. The technical adjustments resulted in some policy choices. In the House, in the A engrossed version, they expanded the credit, the Working Family Household Independent Care Credit, to include more students. And the A17 amendment just provides clarity on how to deal with certain imputed income and spouse income, the lesser of spouse and the taxpayer's income. So I'm just here to answer questions, and Mark is here to talk about any of the property tax things if you have any questions there, but I can't speak to those.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair. So I just wondered, Kyle, I'm not sure if I heard correctly, so maybe it's just a clarification. So for this, if you have a household with two incomes, and I think you gave the example that if one person made $25,000 and the other person made $5,000, it would be based on the lower of the income and would not take into account that other income, the $25,000.
Yeah, Senator, the way that the credit is set up, there, it's almost two parts. So you have, first, you determine the expenses, and then those expenses, the amount of the credit is a certain percentage of those expenses. So there's limits on what the expenses can be. So if you're thinking childcare, the first limit is the actual childcare expenses. Mm-hmm. And then we have the income limits, and then there's hard limits that Oregon has in there of $12,000 per, if you have one individual, or two if you have, or $24,000 if you have two or more children, essentially. So, but yeah, one of the first limits would be the lesser the spouse's income. And that's where that $5,000 came into place, where if one of the spouses is earning less than the other, you would look at that one as the first cap. So if you had $10,000 in childcare expenses, actual expenses, but the lesser the two spouses earned $5,000, to stick with that example, rather than claim $10,000 worth of expenses, you would claim $5,000. And then your credit would be a percentage of that $5,000.
But let's say you lived in a household where one person made $100,000 and the other person's going to school and earned $5,000. Then what happens?
Again, it would be keen off of that, the second person there. There are provisions of federal law to allow imputed income for a joint filers with a spouse. But those are on lesser limits than Oregon's, because the limits at the federal level are lesser.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, to answer Senator Taylor, the point of the credit is to have what's called employment-related expenses. And so this test of income is to make sure that you do have employment-related expenses, which means that those are expenses incurred while you're working, looking for work, or but they do not include expenses when you're going to school. So the test there is to make sure that you have enough, basically you're working or looking for work while you're incurring those daycare costs.
Okay. Senator Belquist.
Oh God, I hate to even bring this up, but you just said, Deanna, employment-related costs?
Employment-related expenses, yes, sir.
Am I missing something here? Under the new tax code, employee expenses are no longer allowed. So are we going to be back fixing this next year? Just a yes or no. Please don't open Pandora's box.
Mr. Chair and Senator Boquist, they're different code sections of the Internal Revenue Code. This is IRC Section 121 with the what employment-related expenses are for daycare purposes. And what you're referring to is FFA itemized deductions, and they're different code sections.
Deanna, that was an outstanding answer.
Right. Don't say any more, please. Let's just move on.
All right.
Thank you.
I'm just going to go through the list here on some of these amendments, and we'll start off with the film technical change in the Oregon Film Tax Credit with Tim Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tim Williams. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Film, the State Film and Video Office. The Oregon Production Investment Fund is an incentive program that we use to both retain and attract productions here in the state. It is funded by an online auction, which is administered by the Department of Revenue. Currently, the legislature has the ability to directly fund this program, but only in a future fiscal year. The change we are requesting under HB 4028A, Section 5 specifically, would allow the legislature to also directly fund the program during a current fiscal year in whole or in part at their discretion. The reason for this is our auction takes place very early in the fiscal year in July, and so we wanted the ability to make any changes to that or adjustments to that with the legislature's help during the same fiscal year as the auction.
Questions? Okay, pretty clear. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ryan Fisher. This is the cemetery amendment.
Thank you very much, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Fisher, and I'm here today on behalf of the owners of Rest Haven Memorial, which is a cemetery in Eugene. I've had a chance to communicate with all of you about this. This is amendment is to remove a barrier to developing affordable housing. And we have a cemetery that has undeveloped property that they would like to sell to a nonprofit in order to develop 172 units of affordable housing. The land would be going from one exempt use to another exempt use, but the way that the cemetery exemption is written, there would be this 10-year clawback penalty, even going from one exempt use to another. So we've worked with the cities and the Department of Revenue to put some pretty tight sideboards around this. And to answer your question from earlier, Representative Riley, how long can the land be held without being developed? So that is actually determined by the affordable housing exemption, and this does not change that. So they would be required to develop it within the timeline that is prescribed by the local jurisdiction over that property tax exemption. If they do not meet the requirements of the property tax exemption, then the clawback would still be in place. So this would not be a way to avoid that and not build the housing.
Questions? Senator Riley.
Thank you. So we discussed this in my office, and I still have the same question. I understand that the plot that we're looking at, the acreage that we're looking at is a 75-acre piece of land, of which 25 acres is currently in cemetery, in actual plots. And 50 acres is waiting.
It's being held for future cemetery use is its current plan, yes.
But my understanding is that the owner has figured out that it's not going to be needed.
More folks are choosing. Yes.
So 15 acres of that is of that 50 is now planned to be sold to a nonprofit for affordable housing. And what's the plan for the other 35 acres that's not being used for cemetery and not being used for affordable housing?
Chair Haas, Senator Riley, I don't believe that there are concrete plans for the remainder of the property at this point.
Okay. All right, so you screwed that one up. So let's go back. You got 25 acres that is presently being utilized. This is an active cemetery and there's people there. You have a total of 75 acres that's in there. The discussion is to take 15 acres of this and transfer it from cemetery nonprofit over to nonprofit housing, correct? Therefore, the remaining acreage is there for future utilization as individuals come in, die, get buried. The sort of indications confuse this is more people want to be burnt and cremated versus being buried in the ground in a box. And so therefore the expansion required over the next reasonable amount of time, which I don't know, I'm thinking he's going to live 20 years, I'm going to live two, so we all have reasonable, but over this expansion time. So we're not really, the other isn't in limbo, that non
partial that we're not talking about that's vacant is really for utilization for future
for
cemetery
future,
purposes?
Yes.
Under the tax code.
Senator Hess, Vice Chair Boquist, thank you very much. That is a very eloquent way of saying
clear
it.
Clear as mud. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ryan. On the housing change, John Van Landingham from the Oregon Law Center. Moving the dates.
Certainly kill it at that.
Thank you, Chair Haas. John Van Landingham, Oregon Law Center. I'll be brief on dash 16 amendments. Kyle described it accurately. Instead of Eugene uses this local option property tax exemption, the sunset extension is 6 months. It's important for that 6 month period. I also worked on section 3 of the bill, the main bill, the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. That's also an important tool for manufactured housing preservation by nonprofits. Happy to answer questions. I appreciate the chair helping us find a way to move forward with the dash 16, which we were at risk of losing.
You were worried. I told you not to worry. Can you summarize the reason for going that extra 6 months on that change?
Chair Huss, you all have historically reviewed exemptions sort of in a group and made decisions whether to extend them for, say, 10 years. This exemption has been in place since, I think, 1989, and it's been renewed every 6, 8, 10 years. For some reason, at some point, it got a date of January 1 instead of July 1.
Okay,
all the others are at July 1. That's the property tax year. I have no idea why it got set at January 1. Moving to July 1 of 2020 will allow us to do what we usually do every 6, 8, 10 years and come to the legislature and explain why this exemption is important and seek a longer extension than just 6 months. We just felt like it wasn't the right time to do it now in the short session to make that kind of review. So we'll be back, and assuming, like Senator Boquist pointed out, we're still alive in 2019 to ask for a longer extension.
Okay, thank you. Note to self, property tax bills, use the July dates.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Bill Cross. This is actually an amendment that we all passed, I think, unanimously in the Senate last year.
Chair Hess, committee members, that is correct. This was Senate Bill 468. Passed.
Name.
Thank you. My name is Bill Cross, and I'm here today on behalf of Willamette Valley Vineyards. Thank you, Senator. Yes, and Mr. Eason has described the three clarifications to the original statute that you all passed actually in 2016, mm-hmm. Senate Bill 1565. And when Marion County looked at adopting a program, some of these questions about eligible property, what the definition of rural did include unincorporated, came up. And so the bill was simply to try and clarify the original statute. And so we would appreciate your approval of the dash 14 amendments.
Questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Tammy Denny.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tammy Denny. I serve as the legislative director for the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. I'm here to speak in favor of the technical correction that exists now in House Bill 4028A, which is the what folks are giggling about in the room, the bovine manure tax credit. In the last full session, we found ourselves addressing what was the methane digester tax credit, now known as bovine tax credit. And this bill in the previous session moved the authority to the Department of Agriculture for the oversight of the administration of this tax credit as it sunsets. And we find ourselves now needing this technical fix, changing the word calendar and tax and making certain that those are going to be agreeable for the individuals who are utilizing this tax credit and most especially for the agency that now was told and promised that this would be a very simple program for them to administer. And as they got into the rule writing weeds, attempting to go about making this simple administration work for the agency, it wasn't so simple. So we're here to speak in favor of the technical fix. Thank you to the committee for your indulgence as we deal with this yet a third time. Hopefully this will be the final time and we allow this bill to this tax credit to finally sunset in 2021. So thank you for your patience. We believe that this is just a technical correction. We speak in favor of it. That's what this short session is about, is getting it right when we didn't get it exactly right in the long session. So thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, any questions?
No, I have a comment though. Any? No questions.
You're
I'm
not,
just curious. Only,
you're
only
not
going to
do the derriere joke.
That's right, okay. Well, only in this committee can the IRS and the Department of Revenue screw up 2,000-3,000 years of history. I mean, there's a difference between cows and cattle, but let's just move on and get this over with. Right? Only taxes and death can screw this up, okay?
Yes.
Having been a dairy farmer, having been a cattle rancher, there is a difference, but hey, whatever helps DOR, let's just get her done.
What about buffalo?
Senator Bocus, things are rolling along so smoothly.
They are.
Happy. Okay, thank you, Tammy.
Thank you.
I tell you, there's some people out there looking pretty curmudgeon right now.
All right, so there's no one else left to sign up here. We have a string of amendments over here, Senator Bocus.
Okay, so let's start down this. And we're going to start at the lower numbers going up. And because the cheat sheet isn't here and the printing is too many, Mr. Chair, I move the A13 dated 2/28/18 into House Bill 4028.
Senator Bocus moves the A13s into House Bill 4028. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, I just need to put I'm fine with this, and they can be fine with all of this. I just want to, I do know that there's some people who don't like this, so I don't know what will happen on the floor. So, but I'm fine.
Okay. Objections? Seeing none, the amendment is added.
Okay, now we got to find the 14. Mr. Chair, I move the A14 dated 2/28/18 into 4028.
Senator Bocus moves the A14s into House Bill 4028. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none. 14s are added.
Okay, are we doing a 15?
No. 16.
16. Okay. I'm gonna find the bloody thing. Mr. Chair, I move the A16 dated 3/1. See, that's why I'm checking these. Into 4028.
Senator Bocus moves the A16s into House Bill 4028. Discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none. 16s are in House Bill 4028.
So, Mr. Chair, I move the A17 dated 3/1 into 4028.
Senator Bocus moves the A17s into House Bill 4028. Discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none. The 17s are added to House Bill 4028.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4028A as amended by the A13, A14, A16 and A17 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Bocus moves House Bill 4028 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Once again, Mr. Chair, I do know that there's some sort of, you know, concerns in opposition to the affordable housing lenders credit portion of this, of the main bill, and I just want to put on the record once again, you know, cows and cattle are different, but I'm fine with it.
Okay. Thank you. And I want to echo Tammy Denny's comments that this is a technical bill involving four or five issues that might not rise to the level of emergency but need fixing. And that's exactly the reason we have these special short sessions. So Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Riley?
Aye.
Senator Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bocus?
Aye.
House votes aye. House Bill 4028, as amended, goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. I will be the carrier. Okay. I'm going to close that work session and public hearing and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill. I'm going to open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1553. Mazin.
You don't suppose.
Before you start, Mazen, this bill will be entirely replaced with language in the amendment.
Yes.
And you're going to speak to the amendment.
The dash C amendment is what's lovingly referred to as a gut and stuff. And, you know, although the calendar says 3-2, it's actually 5 till 12. So that's why you have this bill in front of you. And I put in your SMS the background on what the different ORSs that are relating to the change in the dash three amendment, and being that late and 5 till 12 kind of thing, I would probably allow the people who are actually much more versed into this to testify to that.
Okay. I'll call up Paul Cosgrove and Matt Marquis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. First of all, two thank yous to the chair for allowing us to use this bill, and also to Senator Boquist to allowing use his bill for this technical correction. Last session, this body passed some landmark legislation that Representative Holvey had worked on for a number of years to license and regulate debt buyers. And as part of that, there were new provisions added to the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act applicable to debt buyers. The change that's in the dash three, you have to go to the bottom of page 5 and the top of page 6 to see what the change is. It is revising and replacing the sub T provision of the requirements for people collecting debts. These requirements in sub T were added by House Bill 2356 last session. They were intended only to apply to debt buyers, and when the bill left the building and others outside the building started to see it and ponder it, there was some question about whether that was an ambiguous statement about whether it would apply to others, not just to debt buyers. And I think it's fair to say that everybody who worked hard on the bill, including Mr. Marquis and the Attorney General's Office and the Oregon Law Center, agreed along with Representative Holvey that this was only intended to apply to debt buyers. So the new sub T is to clarify and make unambiguous what the drafters and parties who worked on the bill intended to have it say last session. Happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the Oregon Collectors Association. My colleague, Mr. Cosgrove, did a great job describing what the bill does. I just want to clarify that we do believe the current law says this today. This does make it simpler and clarify that it is, we're talking about purchased debt on this sub T of the Unfair Debt Collection Practices Act. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Who would be, if this wasn't clear, who else besides that? Besides the debt?
Mr. Chair, many kinds of entities, from a retail store to a bank to a credit union, engage eventually in some small proportion, hopefully, of their accounts in a debt collection practices activity, all of which this statute applies to. This new sub T was only designed to apply to the special category of creditors called debt collectors, and that's what we're clarifying.
Okay. I think you meant debt buyers.
Excuse me. I did. Debt buyers. I'm sorry. Pardon me, and thank you to Mr. Marquis for clarifying for the record.
Questions? Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Are you ready? Well, I'm not going to miss the opportunity.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I just want to point out that, and I'm happy to be of convenience for 1553.
Happy to help.
I want to point out that Senator Riley and I have been working on these nonprofit issues for a couple of years now. For all of those full employed lobbyists, which yesterday went into panic mode, I just want, for the record, I did send a little email out, said, yep, it's coming, but not this session. So they all went into panic mode. The nonprofit status issue and those nonprofits that are actually competing in the commercial sector, this was your warning that we're getting ready to do something. for those lobbyists that aren't overly efficient, if you did happen to notice, at the top of the original bill, it is a revenue-raising bill, and it can originate in the Senate. I was just surprised the number of lobbyists that came to my office and happened to miss that point. But with that, Mr. Chair, I move the A3 into 1553, dated 2/28/18.
Senator Boquist moves the A3s into Senate Bill 1553. Discussion. Objections. The amendment is added.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 1553 as amended by the A3 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 1553 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections. Seeing none, Senate Bill 1553 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Boquist, this is your bill.
I don't think you want to give me that opportunity, but I'd be delighted to carry it. I'd be certainly delighted to carry it, you know.
I think sometimes on the floor of the Oregon Senate, you can throw in some editorial aside, so I think you would
Good.
Be okay.
All
right?
All right.
Boquist will be the carrier. Close that work session. And open up a work session and public hearing on House Bill 4080. This is Kyle.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4080 is a bill that's going to be making two changes. The first of which has to do with an update of a connection date to the Internal Revenue Code. So this is relating to ABLE accounts, and it's moving that point-in-time connection date from December 31st, 2015 to December 31st, 2017. So this is similar to the connection dates that this committee saw in Senate Bill 1529. More or less, this ABLE account connection was missed at that time. So it's moving this up from the December 31st, 2015 to the 2017 date. So that's the first change. The second change has to do with the 529 higher education savings accounts. So a change that was made at the federal level in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act to 529 accounts was, and this was passed in December 2017, was to allow up to $10,000 per year to be withdrawn from the 529 account and used essentially for K-12 education rather than just post-secondary higher education. So with Oregon's connection or updating Oregon's connection dates, and Oregon would automatically, or following the update to the connections, would connect to these changes in the 529 accounts. So that would allow withdrawals from the accounts for those K-12 expenses. Now what House Bill 4080 does is it doesn't change what you can do with the 529 account per se, but rather it would require an add back of the tax benefit here in Oregon related to the 529 account. So Oregon has a tax subtraction and then also the interest that's earned, the interest earned on the account is exempt from taxation. So in instances where an individual pulls or removes money from their 529 account for use for K-12 expenses, Oregon will then require an add back to their taxable income on their tax form the amount of the withdrawal that's associated with any prior subtraction, so any prior tax benefit, along with the untaxed interest earnings related to that withdrawal. So the general idea is the 529 accounts here in Oregon from the tax benefit perspective stays consistent with what law was prior to the federal changes. So if you use the funds for higher education purposes, so for college or university purposes, you'd still get the same tax benefit, the same tax subtraction, and the tax exemption on the earnings. If you pull those funds out for K-12 use, if you received any tax benefit here in Oregon in the past, you would be required to repay that tax benefit in the year when you take that withdrawal out. And that's my overview of the changes that I have for you.
Yeah, don't go to that list yet.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Kyle, just to make sure we're clear and everybody out there, especially anybody daring to come up here and testify, this particular issue in the House seemed to got itself derailed into an 1880s, early 1900s discussion that has nothing to do with the topic before us. So, Kyle, what we have right now is really a simple policy choice besides the disconnect, is that we're either going to have the 529 apply only to higher ed, or we have the 529 apply to higher ed in K through 12. That's really where we sit right now. That's the discussion before the Senate. I'm happy to have that discussion, Mr. Chair. I actually think we should do it with all, but I'm just as happy to say we'll come back and visit that later. So I'm supportive of the bill. However, let me just make it exceptionally clear. If somebody wants to go back to the 1800s and the 1900s, that is not going to play out well in this committee or on the floor of the Senate. So I would stick with the issue, which is, do we do it higher ed or do it higher ed and K through 12? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's bring the treasurer team up, Ryan Mann and Michael Parker.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Mann. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon State Treasury. Treasury manages the 529 College Savings Program, which is why we've weighed in on this bill and been consulted on some of the language. It's important to us that the reconnect occurs by passing this bill to keep the program up to date and in compliance with the federal code. Treasurer Reed testified on the House side, and he'd be here himself today. He's in Washington, D.C., so I'll try my best to answer questions on his behalf. But probably more helpful to you all is for me to turn it over to Michael Parker, who has run the 529 program here in Oregon since its inception back in 2001.
Thanks, Ryan. For the record, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon Savings Network. And I will make just really four brief comments and then happy to answer questions as well. Essentially, as Ryan said, this bill, you know, reconnects us back to the federal code on the ABLE side. And then because of the tax bill that was passed by the federal government, it clarifies what's going to happen or what might happen with K through 12 expenses. And so that change does essentially preserve the original legislative intent of when the deduction was passed for college savings back in 1999, of keeping it for higher education. But it does also clarify that folks who do want to use it for K-12 can still get the federal benefits. So we are going to consider that a qualified withdrawal, and we will track that they can take out the $10,000. They will still get the federal benefit of the tax-free growth. They just wouldn't get the state benefit. So we want to make sure that folks know they can use it for K-12. That was important for us to make sure we follow the federal code. But I think what it also does is it focuses our efforts, again, on the original legislative intent of making it for college savings and not for K-12 necessarily savings. And then it keeps the Oregon College Savings Plan and all of our 529 programs really focused on that, really that savings ethic. That was, I think, important to understand is we really try hard to get folks into the plan very early, focus on the savings ethic, and then so they can use the power of compound interest to their benefit over time and focus that effort on college as opposed to focusing that effort on a K-12 expense. So we are, to reiterate, we're going to follow the federal law. We're going to reconnect. We're going to allow folks to take it out for K-12. They will get that federal benefit, but this bill just doesn't allow them to get the state benefit. So with that, I'd happy to answer any questions.
Yeah. Chair, can I make one additional comment? I just wanted to thank Kyle for the summary is in alignment with our understanding of this amendment and then just agree with Vice Chair Boquist on the way the debate went previously was not the intention of the Treasurer's Office. And for us, this has been about the distinction between K-12 and right. Post-secondary education, and we think that that's reflected in these amendments. So thank you.
And Senator, I just want to thank the Treasurer. The Treasurer stayed on message, which is education, and somehow this took a sidetrack, which was regrettable, and we'd like to avoid that in the discussions in the Senate, and hopefully maybe in the future have discussions about, you know, whether it's expandable or not, but we're fine today.
Yeah, and I talked to the Treasurer last night, and he echoes those same sentiments. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Lori Wimmer.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer representing the Oregon Education Association. It's 47,000 members here in support of House Bill 4080. And we have, we also want to thank the State Treasurer's Office with whom we've worked to make sure that this was very carefully finessed as we move forward. As probably comes as no surprise to you, our greatest concern is that public school K-12 funding would be challenged, you know, every time we have another tax break on the books. That of course means that there's less for us to use to do a good job for our students in this state. And so we're eager to do work on a policy that would clarify Oregon's use of its 529 for post-secondary instead of public or private K-12 expenditures, which we think that this bill does, and this seems like a nice compromise. And so we urge your support.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you, Lori.
Thank you.
Right. Okay, we are there, and we have.
We have all the paper. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4080A to the floor with a do pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 4080A to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Other than I look forward to future discussions, but I'm fine with it.
Thank you. I too agree with the idea of saving. When it's K-12, you're not saving. Your pain, and there is a certain ethic in saving for college. So, clerk will call the roll.
Senator Riley.
Aye.
Senator Taylor.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Yep.
Chair Hass.
Hass votes aye. House Bill 4080 will go to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do pass recommendation. Senator Senator Riley will carry this bill. Good work, committee. There's a long list. Thank you for moving into adjournment mode and getting through a lot of these. And thanks to everyone who helped make this an efficient meeting.
And 1 hour notice, right?
1 hour notice. You never know. We are adjourned.
Yeah, I do know. We're